This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
So that's why we're focused on these state capitals, because of the power at state capitals. And if you want to change the nation, you have to change the South. If you want to change the South, you have to change these state capitals. And we believe that this extreme ideological group understands that their narrow-minded agenda doesn't have much longer in the public arena. In other words, the demographics are changing, people are coming together, they know they have a limited amount of time, and so what they're trying to do is reshift public policy, but also, not only reshuffle public policy, they're trying to restructure even how people have access to voting as a desperation to hold on to power.
Reverend Dr. William Barber, we want to thank you for being with us, President of the North Carolina NAACP. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felsar, Monte Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Linton Feed and Seed of Portland has been supporting rural and urban farmers with leading agricultural products since 1946, and they're taking a break to celebrate the summer with you. Join us on Saturday, July 13th, 2013, for Linton's 9th Annual Community Appreciation Come Have a Good Time on Us event, located at Linton Feed and Seed, 10920 Northwest St. Helens Road, Portland, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. You'll enjoy live music by Larry Wilder and the Stumptown Stars, and an old-fashioned barbecue being provided by Poshine's Café de la Soul, plus soda and beer to drink. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
On Friday, July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., tune in for KBOO's one-day flash drive fundraiser, a day filled with news and music from the equator to Antarctica.
Lecture topics will include climate change, gay rights, and an overview of African land grabs. Don't miss out on the chance to explore underrepresented music and news from across the Southern Hemisphere on July 19th from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
The time is now 5:02. You are tuned into KBOO FM Portland. And coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. And the KBOO Evening News has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. Coming up right now, the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, jurors deciding the fate of George Zimmerman conclude their first day of deliberations.
Democrats supporting NSA spying programs are targeted by activists in California.
And local Republicans protest the city's use of tax money to fund public art.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 12, 2013. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Today at a packed courthouse in Sanford, Florida, the jury began deliberations in the trial of George Zimmerman, the self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer who shot and killed unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in February 2012. According to CBS News, the jury has recessed for the day without a verdict, and will resume deliberations tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Second-degree murder convictions can result in life in prison. Earlier this week, the judge said jurors could consider the lesser charge of manslaughter. Dorian Marina from Free Speech Radio News has more.
We're joined by Michael Denzel Smith, Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute. He's been blogging on the Zimmerman trial at thenation.com. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the defense for Zimmerman attempted to make the case in closing arguments that Zimmerman was innocent of murder, that it was an act of self-defense. What has stood out to you in the closing days of this trial?
Well, today, watching the closing arguments from the defense, from Mark O'Meara, he really tried to raise the specter of black criminality and black violence inherent in young black men, and he did it without invoking race specifically. And I think that's what's been really key in watching this trial, is that, you know, whether or not they've been able to talk specifically about racial profiling and race in their arguments, it's in the room with them no matter what. And he's shown the jury these pictures of Trayvon Martin. He's tried to find probably the most menacing photos that he possibly could of Trayvon shirtless and with the hat on and, you know, trying to show off his muscles and trying to say that Trayvon, you know, was an athlete and he could have run a 4-minute mile. I mean, that's like Olympic time that we're talking about when you're talking about a 4-minute mile. But he's really tried to raise the specter of black, you know, athleticism and violence. And then that gives reason to believe that George Zimmerman is telling the truth when he says that Trayvon came out of the bushes or the darkness and punched George Zimmerman in the face without any sort of provocation whatsoever.
Well, you mentioned the defense trying to bolster that account given by Zimmerman of what happened with Martin coming out of the shadows or coming out of bushes. Jurors have heard testimony from more than 50 witnesses during the course of this trial. One of them was 19-year-old Rachel Chantel. She was the last person to speak to Martin before he was killed. Her testimony was scrutinized, defended in the media and online, but somewhat lost is the content of her testimony, that Martin told her that he was being followed, and he asked Zimmerman why he was following him before that call ended. Was the importance of her testimony lost, and how the media reacted?
It has been, to my mind, because hers is it's so crucial. It's so incredibly important because it is the only piece of evidence that directly contradicts the narrative that George Zimmerman has given us. Because there are only two people that know exactly what happened that night, and one of them is dead. And the only person's story that we have left is George Zimmerman, and he's responsible for killing Trayvon Martin. So you have to, his story is the one to go on. He's innocent until proven guilty. But Rachel Jontel's testimony directly contradicts the way that he says that the event took place. The initial meeting between himself and Trayvon Martin took place. And if the jury believes Rachel Jontel, then there's, to my mind, enough evidence to suggest that George Zimmerman was indeed the aggressor in this situation, and that he wasn't necessarily fearing for his life when he was the one who caused the contact. He was the one with the gun.
The killing of Martin focused the nation's attention on Florida's Stand Your Ground law. That's the law that expands the rights of an armed person to use deadly force if they feel they are threatened. Zimmerman's defense did not invoke that specifically in his defense, but Michael Denzel Smith, you've written that even ending the Stand Your Ground laws in Florida and other states wouldn't be enough to prevent another killing like Martin's. What do you mean?
What I mean is, you know, Stand Your Ground was important in considering why George Zimmerman wasn't arrested, because it gave police discretion to decide that George Zimmerman didn't need to be arrested for killing Trayvon Martin. You know, even before we get to all that, what we're talking about is George Zimmerman profiling and stalking Trayvon Martin. And why did he do that? He believed Trayvon Martin to be a suspicious person. And why did he believe him to be a suspicious person when there's plenty of Sanford, the city of Sanford, I believe, is majority black. Why did he believe that Trayvon Martin didn't belong in that neighborhood. Why did he not think that he was simply walking home? He found this person suspicious, and I believe he found them suspicious on the basis of seeing a young black man. And until we address that, we'll have more Trayvon Martins, and we have had them. We've had, you know, young black men be killed. In the same state of Florida, Jordan Davis was killed because he was sitting in his car and playing loud music, and someone, an older white man, approached him and said, you know, turn it down. And then apparently he took out his gun and shot them because he thought he saw a gun, but no gun was found there. That's the belief that there's a gun in the hands of young black men where there is none. That's what I'm talking about when I say, you know, stand your ground. Obviously, is to me egregious, but you know, you still, even without stand your ground, people are still going to be fearful of black youth unless we address that.
Michael Denzel Smith is a Knobler Fellow at the Nation Institute and blogger at thenation.com. He joined us to discuss the trial of George Zimmerman and the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dorian Marina from Free Speech Radio News with the latest on the trial of George Zimmerman.
As reported yesterday on KBOO, protesters will gather tonight for a demonstration against the city's plan to close Mount Tabor Park's open-air reservoirs. The protesters, who call themselves Camp Cascadia and Occupy Mount Tabor, will meet at the park at Southeast 60th Avenue and Southeast Salmon Street at 5 p.m. tonight. The protesters will not be allowed to stay past the park curfew of midnight. "It's our 11th hour," said Jesse Sponberg, a protest organizer. He seeks an EPA waiver with the help of an Oregon congressional delegation. The EPA gave Rochester, New York, a waiver with the help of New York Senator Schumer. Such a waiver could save Portland water ratepayers over $400 million, the projected cost to build the new reservoirs. Portland water bills are already the third highest in the nation, according to Sponberg. Sponberg predicted as many as 400 people could turn out for tonight's protest. He said protest organizers would make, quote, a real thoughtful decision, end quote, about whether to stay the night, and, quote, we definitely might have a standoff, quote, end quote, after midnight, Sponberg said.
A Portland cyclist and driver are being treated in hospital for injuries following a collision that occurred this morning. The automobile hit the bicyclist at Northeast 28th and Killingsworth. Police responded around 8:15 a.m. They described the driver's injuries as non-life-threatening and the cyclist's injuries as traumatic but also non-life-threatening.
The Portland Streetcar is offering free rides across the Broadway Bridge during scheduled maintenance next week. From 9 a.m. on Tuesday through 5:30 a.m. on Friday, the bridge's sidewalk will be closed to cyclists and pedestrians. During that time, cyclists will be rerouted to the steel bridge, and pedestrians will be offered free rides on the streetcar. Streetcar fares will not be enforced on westbound rides from the North Broadway and Ross Avenue station to the Northwest 11th Avenue and Northrop Street station. Fares will also be free on eastbound rides from Northwest 9th Avenue and Lovejoy Street station to the North Widler Street and Ross Avenue station. Outside of that zone, the fares for rides on the Portland streetcar will remain $1.
Yesterday, members of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Oregon gathered at the east end of the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland to protest a recent public art installation. The sculpture is called Inversion Plus Minus. It represents the outline of a foundry called the Phoenix Iron Works, which shut down in 1957. Caucus members made signs in the back room of the office of Chair James Buchall before eight members protested the latticework of rusty steel shaped like a building. The signs urged drivers to honk if they disapproved of the use of tax money to fund public art. The sculpture cost $700,000. It was paid for by the Percent for Art Fund from the budget of the Portland Streetcar's East Side Loop. KBOO reporter James Gallivan was at the protest and asked participants how the public was reacting.
So we've been here 10 minutes. How's it going?
Very well, very well. People are honking to show their agreement with us and saying right on and things like that. Who would have thought that Portland had so many art-hating Philistines, right? It's a slow process raising public awareness, but one mind at a time.
Okay, how's it going?
I think it's actually going very well. We've had a lot of excellent responses from people. Actually, a lot more than I thought. I didn't think people would honk for this, but I'm surprised. They are honking. We've had a couple of negative comments, and we have had a couple of people that really surprised me were kind of very upset at what we were doing, which really I don't understand.
What would you say the breakdown is by percentage of positive and negative?
Oh, I'd say it's about 85% positive. So I believe that this is what people really believe. It's not, you know, what the bureaucrats tell us they believe.
Yeah, hi, I'm Cliff Hutchison. I'm the secretary of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Oregon. It's the organization that sponsored this demonstration today. It's clear to see. You can't hide this spending of money. It's right here in these sculptures. And this is example 2% for art, which city council passed on their own prerogative. It's not something voters decided.
Is the problem with this piece of art the, you know, you don't like the look of it? If it was different, could you have tolerated the public expense?
No, it helps a little bit that it's in the view of many people not very good looking, but that's not the main reason. That's not even one of the main reasons.
This is James Buechel. I think today was a success. It's a slow process, waking people up to the degree to which the government is misallocating their scarce capital into white elephants, but it's a process that's occurring throughout the economy. It's not just art. As we heard the cars drive by today and honk and wave in appreciation and give us a thumbs up, we could see that we're beginning to wake people up.
That was Joseph Gallivan talking to members of the Republican Liberty Caucus protesting public art near the Hawthorne Bridge.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight's show focuses on children's health. Mardika Hicks from the Children's Community Clinic, which provides health care for children of low-income families, will join host Della Ray for the discussion. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny, with a high near 80.
It's 5:17. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Poverty in America, bigger than ever and rapidly spreading. Today's turbulent economic waters are sweeping millions of Americans downstream from the middle class into poverty. And that's our nation's true economic crisis. Already, the USA has crossed an embarrassing threshold of economic infamy. 50 million poor people. Poor means they are trying to make ends meet on $11,000 or less a year for an individual, $15,000 a year for a single mom with one child, and $23,000 for a family of four. 50 million Americans. That's literally a nation of poverty in our midst, roughly the equivalent of the entire population of South Korea. Meanwhile, another 51 million Americans are classified as near poor, an individual making between $11,000 and $17,000 a year. So, more than 100 million of our people, one in three of us, are either poor or perched precariously on the brink of that abyss. Yet, Washington offers no anti-poverty agenda. Republicans simply blame the poor for their poverty, claiming they lack initiative and family morals. Democrats are mostly playing defense, trying to swat down the meanest efforts by Republicans to further hurt the poor. But society's moral imperative to extend a helping hand to the least among us, as Jesus put it in the New Testament, cannot be fulfilled merely with balm, food, and clothing. Rather, our major focus should be on the cracks themselves. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's a true populist perception. People fall between the cracks because there are cracks. You wouldn't put up with that in your home, nor should we let this structural damage spread through our national house. America's poverty numbers, including the already poor, the near poor, and those rapidly tumbling down, are disgraceful, made all the more so by the fact that we're living in the richest country in the world. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Activists are gathering in Marin County, California on Saturday to picket a fundraiser for Congressional House Democrats. The keynote speaker for the big-ticket fundraiser is House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who's taken heat for her support of President Obama's NSA spying programs. The protesters, many who identify as Democrats, are gathering under a group called the Coalition of Grassroots Progress. For more on the story, KABU's Kristen Yount spoke with Alice Chan, an organizer and speaker at tomorrow's protest.
Alice Chan co-chairs the Coalition of Grassroots Progress and is also the leader of Progressive Democrats of Sonoma County. She's an elected delegate from the Assembly District 10 to the California Democratic Central Committee. Hello, Alice. Tell me about what prompted the coalition to picket this fundraiser and what is the nature of the fundraiser.
I'm very happy to talk about this. It's been more than a month since it was widely reported that the NSA is spying on Americans via their phone calls and their emails. And there has been pretty much a deafening silence from most members of Congress around the outrage that this should have been bringing out to everyone. One exception to the silence has been Nancy Pelosi, Representative Nancy Pelosi, who is the Democratic Party leader in the House of Representatives, the minority leader, and she has been a major defender of the Obama administration's program on spying. One of the things that people have said is that it's just metadata that the NSA is collecting, which means they're just collecting the phone number that you call from, the phone number that you call, how long that call lasts. But really, if you think about it, that is as bad as being followed. If you were driving from your home to somebody else's home and you saw that someone was following you, and then once they got to that person's home, they started following whenever those people got in their car and drove someplace or walked someplace, we would all be pretty upset. And tracking the metadata of our phone calls is exactly as intrusive as that. In fact, they can find out as much as they want about us by tracking that kind of data, and it's stored for 5 years, whether you are guilty of a crime or not. This is a major invasion of our privacy. If this program had been expanded under a president that was a Republican, I imagine that we would have seen quite a bit of outrage on Capitol Hill from the Democrats. But since it's a Democratic Party president that we have now in the White House, the Democrats are probably under quite a bit of pressure to be silent, not criticize the program. There's been a few notable exceptions. Representative Alan Grayson from Florida has been outstanding in calling attention to the outrages of this kind of privacy violation. But by and large, our representatives are being quiet. So Nancy Pelosi is coming to Congressional District 2 in California. She is the representative from San Francisco, so she's coming across the Golden Gate Bridge and appearing at a high-dollar fundraiser in Belvedere. And my Congress member, Jared Huffman, has invited a bunch of people to come to this fundraiser for her. Since she doesn't respond to our phone calls, we decided that we would just go to that location and carry signs telling her and telling the people that are going to that fundraiser how we feel about NSA spying on us in these unacceptable ways. And that's why we have picked this particular fundraiser to picket.
Can you give us the web address of where the coalition can be found online?
It's www.grassrootsprogress.org. And you'll see quite a bit of information about the events there. You'll see our mission statements, the things that we are concerned about and why we formed ourselves.
The protest will take place on Saturday at 1 p.m. at the corner of Golden Gate Avenue and Eucalyptus Road in Belvedere.
That was KABU's Kristen Yount speaking with Alice Chan, an organizer of tomorrow's picket targeting fundraiser for House Democrats. The minimum cost for the fundraiser is $1,000 per plate.
A U.S. judge upheld a subpoena allowing Chevron Corporation access to the IP usage records and identity information of more than 100 journalists, activists, and attorneys. New York District Court Judge Lewis Kaplan ruled to enforce the subpoena. The subpoena gives Chevron access to Microsoft information. It's part of a suit addressing Chevron's alleged environmental contamination in Ecuador. Chevron claims to be the victim of conspiracy in the case. For more, KBOO's Stephen Sherritt spoke with Marissa Valsing of Earth Rights International and Nate Cardoso of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Why is Judge Kaplan allowed to waive First Amendment rights for individuals who are likely U.S. citizens without further investigation?
So, frankly, he's not. Judge Kaplan based his ruling on an inappropriate and inaccurate factual assumption, which was that none of our clients are U.S. citizens. He didn't ask, and the parties didn't brief it, and that's not a basis that federal judges are allowed to rule from.
I think that this decision needs to be understood in the broader context of the case in which Chevron is going after more than 50 activists, lawyers, and plaintiffs who brought a case against Chevron and won in Ecuador for years of environmental contamination. This subpoena issued to Microsoft seeking the information of account holders under Hotmail is just one of many that have been issued to non-party witnesses with little, if any, relationship to this case at all. And from our perspective, it's just harassment, and we don't see a reason why they needed to subpoena them for this information when they could have just used other mechanisms that are involved in the civil discovery process. It was really startling to me, even reading the subpoena, what Chevron was seeking and how invasive it is to think that, you know, if you're logging into your email account from these various IP addresses, that someone could track your movements and get a sense of your personal relationship. I know that there have been some parallels with the NSA spying, and I guess the parallel that I see here is that what you have in the NSA story is that you have the NSA asking corporations to work for it to gather information, you know, Verizon, AT&T. But here you have the government working through the process of a court order or court-sanctioned discovery to gather information on behalf of a corporation or help assist with the gathering of information for a corporation.
Is there anything that's currently being done to combat this decision?
Yeah, we move for reconsideration. We think that that's extremely unlikely given the judge that we have in New York. But if he declines to reconsider his ruling, we will appeal to the Second Circuit.
That was KBOO's Stephen Sherritt with the latest on the tactics Chevron is using to fight an $18 billion judgment for environmental contamination in Ecuador.
To date, Twitter complied with a Paris High Court order to give French authorities user data linked to a series of anti-Semitic tweets. The tweets, which appeared last October, were hashtagged with the French phrases for a good Jew and a dead Jew. Twitter immediately removed the offensive comments when users complained. After the tweets were deleted, the French Union of Jewish Students and four other groups asked Twitter to release the user data since speech that incites racial hatred is illegal in France. When Twitter would not provide identifying information, all five anti-racism organizations asked a judge to compel the microblogging company to comply. In January, a judge ruled against Twitter, stating the tweets violated France's anti-hate speech statutes. Last month, the Paris Appeals Court refused to hear Twitter's appeal and insisted the company hand over the user's data. According to the BBC, the president of the French Union of Jewish Students issued a statement saying, quote, "This agreement is a reminder that you cannot do anything you want on the Internet. Twitter will no longer be a conduit for racists and anti-Semites where their anonymity will be protected," end quote. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call on us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ren Green, Carl Vischer, Stephen Sherritt, Josie Lycan, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Rebecca Ney. Special thanks to Kristen Yount, Joseph Gallivan, and the reporters from Free Speech Radio News. More national and international stories can be found on their website, fsrn.org. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with Sabine Heinlein about her book Among Murderers, Life After Prison, and the issues of rehabilitation and rejoining society. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locust Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Sarah Canterbury and Rachel Freifelder of Living City about what you can plant between now and fall to feed yourself this winter. At 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall speaks with Jim Gavella and Amy Thompson of Oregon State University's Counseling and Psychological Services. The theme is mental health for college students. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Ren Green speaks with Peter Clark of the upcoming What the Festival. They'll talk about the music, art, performance workshops, and film screenings at the festival. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member yet, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, Della Ray talks to Madrika Hicks from the Children's Community Clinic. It provides health care for children of low-income families. Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, as a big part of the media discussion on Egypt's coup focuses on whether it was indeed a coup, our guest, Middle East Report editor Chris Tensing, says we're asking the wrong questions. He'll join us to talk about Egypt, year three. Also on the show, Public Broadcasting's Gwen Ifill says media, quote, spend a long time talking about the sequester and the fiscal cliff and all of these terrible things which are about to happen. They didn't really happen, close quote. Should we all be as relieved as Ifill suggests about the real-world impact of sequestration? We'll hear from Nation contributor and Think Progress economic policy editor Bryce Covert. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
It's not every day that you hear a TV reporter talk about all the things he doesn't know. But here's NBC Meet the Press host David Gregory on July 7th talking about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
I don't understand exactly how the exchanges are going to work. Uh-huh. I don't understand all the ins and outs of the employer mandate and how that works. But anybody who gets a paycheck in this country understands one thing, yeah. That there's a new line item, and it says Medicare surtax. So the tax part's working.
Yeah,
you're paying more in taxes for Obamacare. That part's working. It makes a lot of people mad.
So he doesn't know a lot about the law, but the part that he thinks he knows, that every worker is paying a new Obamacare tax, isn't true. That additional Medicare tax is paid by people making over $200,000. That'd be the top 2% of household income. People like David Gregory, in other words, and maybe most of the people he knows.
Washington Post intelligence columnist Walter Pincus has a conspiracy theory about NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. In a July 9th column, he suggested that Snowden wasn't acting on his own, but was being controlled by WikiLeaks in cahoots with Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald, who may have directed him to take the job at Booz Allen as part of a broader plan. It's suspicious, Pincus says, that Snowden had access to NSA documents after working there less than 3 months. And it's happened before, he said, citing U.S. prosecutors' claims that Private Bradley Manning was being directed by WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. Greenwald and his colleague on the Snowden story, Laura Poitras, are in league with the group too, Pincus says. The proof? Quote, on April 10, 2012, Greenwald wrote for the WikiLeaks Press's blog about Poitras and WikiLeaks being targeted by U.S. government officials, close quote. Also, Assange knew about Snowden's story before it was published in The Guardian. He previewed it on Democracy Now! When he said, all the calling records of the United States already are entered into the national security complex. Pincus closes, alleging that WikiLeaks is still helping Snowden, adding ominously, quote, what other roles the group played in getting Snowden to this point remain a mystery, close quote. It's Pincus's bad luck that Glenn Greenwald reads The Washington Post because he's refuted every central fact of that piece. He never wrote for the WikiLeaks blog. The article was from Salon. Snowden had worked for various NSA contractors for 4 years, not 3 months. The idea that Assange previewed the story on Democracy Now!, Greenwald notes, should be deeply embarrassing for someone who claims even a passing familiarity with surveillance issues, because Assange was talking about well-documented Bush-era NSA programs. The Post issued a long, detailed correction of Pincus's column. They could have saved themselves some time if they'd just said, never mind.
On NBC Nightly News on July 9th, anchor Brian Williams made an announcement.
There is consumer product news tonight. The folks at Hamburger Helper say they'd like to be thought of more as just helpers, since more and more people are eating chicken, and there's a helper for that, too. General Mills say they just want to help dinner in America.
Viewers were left to wonder what else might have been in the press release. Early the next day, NBC's Today Show, also in the news department, brought viewers the news that the company Dyson has a new floor cleaning device. The company founder, who Matt Lauer explained comes up with all kinds of cool products, was brought on. And at one point, Savannah Guthrie exclaimed that she was sure the thing would be, quote, another one of those things where we think, yes, why did we wait so long for this invention, close quote. For those viewers searching the screen for a toll-free number, Lauer clarified.
We don't do this as a commercial. We do it because there is a cool factor attached to your products. And when other people develop cool products, we'll bring those on as well.
The lesson seems to be buying advertising is for suckers.
ABC correspondent Jonathan Carl is the most visible product of the Collegiate Network, a right-wing outfit that supports conservative campus publications and funds internships at Beltway media outlets aimed at getting more right-wing journalists into news outlets. What the network seeks is more journalism like Carl's July 7th interview with former President George W. Bush for This Week. Many another reporter would be embarrassed at the image polishing session, which focused on Bush's charity work in Africa, where Carl told him, "You're something of a rock star." And no, asking Bush whether he agrees with Obama's assessment that his AIDS relief policy was one of his crowning achievements does not count as tough questioning. At one point, Carl asked the man who launched an illegal and horrific war that killed hundreds of thousands of people to assess the suggestion that his Africa work is an attempt to atone for mistakes in Iraq. Bush declared that absurd psychobabble. As fawning as the whole thing was, and Bush even joked about how presidents tend to get criticized and then added, but not from you, John, Bush still insisted on circumscribing it. When Carl asked if his views on same-sex marriage had evolved, Bush refused to answer, saying he was off the stage unless I'm promoting something I strongly believe in. He didn't add, or unless I'm talking to a softballer like you, but gosh knows by that point he didn't need to.
And finally, few would fault media for their attention to Texas State Senator Wendy Davis. Her June 25th filibuster in opposition to a rigid anti-abortion bill was remarkable. But there's something worrisome about the gap between the 737 U.S. news stories mentioning Davis between June 23rd and 29th and the 72 stories over a similar period mentioning abortion restrictions passed in Ohio's budget. The Ohio bill will make it hard for family planning groups to get funding. It could suspend public funding for rape crisis clinics if they counsel victims on abortion options. And it mandates that whatever doctors recommend, women seeking an abortion must undergo a fetal ultrasound. And doctors must tell them if there is a fetal heartbeat. The Ohio story may have lacked the drama of the Texas filibuster, but as states around the country begin to propose and enforce similar legislation, the public has to hope that media will find the rolling back of women's basic human rights dramatic enough to be newsworthy in itself.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
The overthrow of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has led to a storm of debate over whether his ouster by the Egyptian military was a coup or something else. But our guest says debating whether it was a coup is asking the wrong question. Chris Tensing is the editor of Middle East Report magazine and the co-author of the magazine's editorial on the coup, Egypt in Year 3. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Chris Tensing.
Thank you very much.
Well, surveying the commentary on Egypt, it seems clear that pro-democracy and progressive types are all over the board when it comes to opinions about the coup. I feel that your editorial, that is Middle East Report's editorial, goes some way in explaining why people might be confused by events in Egypt. We obviously think that it's a coup at Counterspin, and there was also, obviously, a massive popular uprising against Morsi. But you say that debate asks the wrong question. What are some of the questions that we should be asking here?
Well, I think the reason for the confusion is that people are confused about the definition of democracy. I think a lot of liberals in the West and more centrist commentators as well tend to view democracy only as an exercise that happens every 4 years or every 6 years at the ballot box, and that the act of voting is the extent of it. There is also a much deeper view of democracy, however, which looks at when people put their bodies on the line in demonstrations, in sit-ins, in strikes, in other kinds of collective action that assert the popular will. So the right question to ask is, what are the deeper historical trends in Egypt of which these events in late June and early July were a part? And for that, you need to go back certainly to the 2011 uprising that unseated Hosni Mubarak, but also further back than that to see that there is a long struggle on the part of the Egyptian people to have a greater say in their own governance and to have a more decent standard of living and to have less truncated life chances than they have had under a series of authoritarian governments. And there is an establishment in Egypt, the core of which is the army, which resists those aspirations. And so the answer to the big question is that there is both a revolution and a coup. There's, if you like, it's a coup wrapped inside an ongoing revolution, the outcome of which is still very uncertain.
A year ago, one of your co-writers of the editorial, Joshua Stocker, explained in a New York Times op-ed that the elections were really a victory for the army. I think that's an important point to make, that in some sense, Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood, who cooperated with the military in several exploits until the military soured on them, always served at the pleasure of the military and other factions of Egypt's so-called deep state. I wonder if you could explain a little more of that for us.
Yeah, the army is the core, along with the security services and civilian holdovers from the old regime of what is called the deep state in Egypt. It's a concept that comes from Turkey, where for many years the army was also the power behind the throne of successive civilian governments. And the basic concept is that the army calls a lot of the shots in Egypt as the power behind the throne, behind the scenes, They don't want to rule the country directly. Rather, they search for civilian partners who can be presented to the Egyptian public and to the international community as legitimate somehow, chosen by the Egyptian people. But those civilian partners are not to cross certain red lines that the army has. The army does not want civilian oversight over its vast budget. It does not want civilian oversight over its own economic empire in Egypt, all of the factories and port facilities and so on that the military operates. And it does not want any limitations on its own accountability. And the same goes for the Interior Ministry and other parts of the Egyptian police state. So the Muslim Brothers were useful in that they were the best organized political force in Egypt. They had been repressed by the old regime, the Mubarak regime, and so they could be presented as something different, fresh. But they were also willing to cut that deal with the army, whereby they wouldn't seek to have meaningful oversight over the army's prerogatives. So the partnership was perfect in those ways, but then the army saw an opportunity in this uprising on June 30th to consolidate their grip even further.
Now, to be clear, Middle East Report is not saying that the coup was a good thing. When you say that the coup was part and parcel of an ongoing revolution, you're not saying that the coup won't have and is not having some bad results.
No, absolutely not. It's a setback for the revolution in many ways. It's a setback for it is important that there be procedural democracy that is the results of which are respected and so on. It's a setback for that concept. In many ways, if you want to put it this way, the uprising on June 30th was hijacked by authoritarian elements in the same way that the Iranian Revolution in 1979 was hijacked by authoritarian Islamist elements for ends that had little to do with the aspirations of a lot of the people in the streets. But what we're simply trying to do in the piece is zoom out a little bit and take a more long-durée historical approach to viewing the events and holding open the possibility that this is a setback, but in a longer process that has yet to play itself out,